He was so afraid before he walked in today, terrified that he'd be sent back to that torture. And we tried to reassure him and tell him, no, no, there has to be some semblance of justice, right? No.
ICE arrests a local religious leader. What happened with his asylum in the U.S.? This is Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. We dive into his case today on the Friday News Review. Plus, the veto is making waves in the Ohio State House, the crime surge in Cincinnati, and funding cuts hit Indiana Public Radio. Joining me now to get our news review started are WVXU local government reporter Becca Costello, Cincinnati Inquirer investigative reporter Dan Horn, and Cincinnati Inquirer breaking news reporter Cameron Knight. Welcome back, everybody.
Thanks.
Thanks, Lucy.
Thanks.
Dan, this local religious leader who was detained by ICE earlier this week, who is he?
So his name is Amon Solomon, and he came from Egypt to the United States in 2014 after he said he had been persecuted by Egyptian authorities there because of his work, working as a journalist covering the Arab Spring movement. So he had claimed at the time he had been arrested, detained, beaten, tortured, and essentially fled the country when he came to this country in 2014. He left behind a wife and a child there and had hoped to bring them back here with him at some point.
And I understand he worked at Cincinnati Children's at some point. What did he do there?
He did. He was a chaplain at Cincinnati Children's for several years, and he had also worked as a religious leader in Egypt, and had done some work like that here as well, in addition to Cincinnati Children's at the Clifton Mosque.
Do we know if he still works as a chaplain at Cincinnati Children's, or if not, when or why that job ended?
He does not. Our belief is that Children's isn't talking, but our belief is that he when his asylum was revoked in early June, he had lost the ability to work in this country, and so his job there went away. So he's no longer working there.
Okay. You mentioned, and I believe I might be remembering incorrectly, but wasn't his asylum revoked in December of 2024?
Well, it is a complicated tale, but essentially he was told in December 2024 that Homeland Security intended, or that Customs Enforcement had intended to revoke his asylum, which was granted in 2018. So he'd been here from 2014 to 2018. Asylum was granted in 2018, and then in December 2024 he was told that the government was intending to revoke that. The actual revocation of that did not happen until June of this year. So that just happened a little over a month ago.
I see. Okay. Well, and I understand that a while back he filed suit against the government. Can you explain that lawsuit and whether that might have had anything to do with his asylum status?
Well, he believes it does, and his attorneys believe it does. So he, his asylum was granted in 2018. He began working in this country, and one of the jobs that he had applied for was a prison chaplain job in Oregon. He had lived out there for a period of time, and while they were vetting him on a background check, it emerged that there was an FBI flag of some sort on him in that background check. And he essentially lost his job out there that he had he actually did start at some point. He was able to work for a period of time. But he did not end up keeping that job because he couldn't pass the background check because of this FBI flag. At that point, he sued to the government to find out why there was a flag on him, what it was about, and seeking to remove it. His position was he'd done nothing wrong. He committed no crimes in this country. Nothing had changed since his asylum application was granted in 2018. And there's no reason why there should be a flag on him. So he filed suit. That suit is still pending, the primary suit. There were some other ancillary lawsuits, but the primary suit is still pending. His attorney believes that suit and his disagreement with the government contributed to the decision to revoke his asylum status.
Hmm. I know supporters gathered to protest his detainment earlier this week. That's where we got the audio that we heard at the top of this discussion. Tell us about that protest.
Well, his supporters, there are many at both at his work at Children's Hospital and at that protest, basically are saying that he's been treated unfairly, that he did good work at Children's Hospital. He was supportive of patients and their families. His colleagues there, several of them wrote glowing letters about his time there. And others have pointed to this also as a kind of a case study in what's wrong with the American immigration, with the asylum system, how it works, and that folks like Mr. Solomon get caught up in it and are unable to resolve the problems that they're experiencing so they can stay in this country.
And how many people were at that protest? Were there... It sounds like
about 75. Yeah, there were about 75 people at that protest. And in addition to that, there were about 20 who have written letters so far to the government in an effort to get them to reconsider their decision to revoke his asylum.
I understand Mr. Solomon has a lawyer. What has his lawyer said about all this?
Well, the lawyer's position is that the government has been uncooperative from the outset in explaining the FBI flag. Their position is there was an error, that a fingerprint linked to him in the FBI database or in the government database was not actually his fingerprint, and that needed to be corrected. And they were seeking information about what exactly the government has on him that would prompt them to put a flag on him. The government's position is that they can't talk about any of that. It's a national security matter. The courts have generally supported them in that view, that disclosing who's on these lists, who's on watch lists, who's in their database would be a breach of national security. So that is closed off. They did say in their lawsuit, the government did say in this lawsuit, that it did take some steps to review his they did a review based on his lawsuit, based on his complaint. And that they made any corrections to the records that were necessary. But they wouldn't tell him what those corrections were. They wouldn't tell him what's in the database. So, you know, their position is we just don't have enough information to understand what the government is doing and why it's doing it.
Has ICE made any comment about all this?
They have not.
Okay.
So, yeah, we've not heard from ICE. We've not heard from the FBI. You know, none of the folks who would be involved in creating these databases, managing them, or making these decisions have discussed, you know, the reasons for why he would lose his asylum status at this point.
Is there any idea what's next for him? Is there a possibility he'll be deported back to Egypt?
Well, there is a possibility he will be, but excuse me, his attorneys have argued that he should be permitted to stay until these questions are answered. I know Representative Landsman has said that he's received assurances that he won't be deported until some of these questions are answered. But we don't know. We've not heard that from ICE, and we've not heard it from anyone in a position to tell us with certainty that that's going to happen. But at the moment, he is detained, he is deportable. I mean, without asylum status, the government can deport you. Asylum status can be granted, it can be removed for any number of reasons. And once it's removed, you're deportable.
Well, thank you, Dan. I want to turn now to our reporters in the studio with us. There were more deadly shootings in the region this week. The city also gave an update on violent crime. Becca, do city officials think crime numbers are going in the right direction now?
The answer is sort of. I think officials, both Mayor Aftab Purval and Police Chief Teresa Thiege, are hesitant to say that, you know, things are definitely going the right direction. But just looking at some of the numbers, looking at crime over the last 28 days, violent crime compared to the same 28 days the year before is about steady. It's a 1.2% increase, which basically just means two more incidents of violent crime. Looking at year to date, so from the start of 2025 compared to the same time period last year, violent crime is down about 3%. The shootings in particular have more significant decreases, both in the number of shooting incidents and the number of shooting victims. But both Chief Thigy and Mayor Pureval say, you know, they're hesitant to say that this is a long-term trend. These are very short-term trends. It's very difficult to predict, you know, what that might look like over the next several weeks. Pureval said, we're encouraged by the current data and optimistic and hopeful that it will continue, but they're not willing to kind of project how successful these efforts will be.
Cameron, Becca just mentioned shootings, and just this week, a 14-year-old was fatally shot in Avondale. A 15-year-old died from a gunshot wound in Wyoming. Can you tell us briefly about these cases?
Yeah, there's been several cases recently. The big news from today has been the shooting in Wyoming. The 14-year-old who was arrested and charged with murder in that shooting appeared in juvenile court this morning. And our reporter, Kevin Grasha, discovered at that hearing that shooting stemmed from a gun sale between the victim and the shooter, according to prosecutors. And then last night, there was a vigil held for Jameer Hill. He was the 15-year-old who was killed in Wyoming. And our reporter, Jillian Stavazinski, was there and spoke to the family who highly regarded this teenager and believed he was a good kid. And the message from some of the folks there was a kind of a denouncement of just gun violence in general and the proliferation of guns everywhere. And one of the uncles there said that everyone just needs to put the guns down. Mm-hmm. And I think that the gun violence that we're seeing is troubling, but the overall crime trends in the city, as Becca said, it's shootings themselves are down way down. Frankly, we've had 151 shooting people shot this year in the city, and compared to the same time last year, it was 188. So that's more than 30 fewer shootings than last year.
Cameron, I know that both of you were at this press conference that city leaders had earlier this week to talk about violent crime. Did city leaders address that Avondale shooting during the press conference, Cameron?
I don't know if they did or not. Okay. I don't believe so.
But. I don't believe so either.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, Becca, talk to us about some of the strategies that city leaders say are working to help reduce crime.
Yeah, so there are several of them. The two kind of primary ones that were the focus of this update this week were what they're calling a street crimes task force. This is a relatively new task force of officers, about 30 officers, also some managers and supervisors, who are focused on basically whatever the data says they need to be focused on. So this is a task force that has been in full operation for about a week and a half. At the time of the press conference, it had been about a week. They've made 53 arrests so far, including recovering 12 firearms. Of those, they say two were confirmed had been stolen before they were recovered by police. One of the other things that they touted this week is an increased use of drones and gave a couple of specific examples. So one thing that they can use drones for, and they showed some video of this, was, you know, let's say a park like Smale Riverfront Park, where we do tend to see a lot of teen activity. It does close at some point, and so they can fly the drone over with a pretty powerful large spotlight and look for folks who are still in the park. There's also a speaker, and they can say over the speaker on the drone, the park is now closed. You need to make your way home and not be in the park anymore. But they can also use it in very specific situations. So, for example, they showed video of a couple of men who were seen on the video with a gun. It looked like they were kind of posing for pictures or social media videos. And the chief explained that the reason they had that drone footage was someone had reported a suspicious behavior. Instead of sending a police officer to check that out, they sent a drone instead and have this really pretty high quality video footage. They say based on that footage, they then pulled over that man in a traffic stop, realized he was 18, which means it is illegal to have a concealed weapon in Ohio until you're 21. And that weapon they did confiscate and was found to have a device on it that turns it into an automatic weapon, which can make it considerably more dangerous.
Mm. Cameron, I want to return to this deadly shooting in Wyoming. It seems like that's pretty unusual because Wyoming has so few shootings. How uncommon or common is it for Wyoming to see violence like that?
It's extremely uncommon. I think in the past 5 years they've had just maybe a handful of aggravated assaults. Based on data that they reported to the FBI, they haven't had a homicide in at least 10 years. The last fatal shooting in the city of Wyoming was a police shooting, which was as a result of a conflict between police and a person who was trying to kind of speed away in a vehicle. And it's just very uncommon. And that's the thing about all of the crime stats is that we look at like Wyoming, which is actually not in the city, mm-hmm. and then there's the city neighborhoods. The citywide statistics are kind of flat across the board, but there's certain areas where you're seeing like big upticks in crime, like in the Central Business District and District 1, which are sort of what I would consider the urban core of Cincinnati, like property crimes through the roof, some of those other things. But the de facto standard for years was like, what's going on with shootings? And shootings right now are not really a great metric of how people are feeling, and they're not really a great metric of what the folks at the police department are kind of focused on kind of combating.
Mm-hmm. What are they focused on combating?
So, Becca said they have this roving task force. They're looking at gun crime and everything. One of the continuous themes that's kind of been thumped on for the past, I would say, 2 years at least, is juvenile crime. So they've looked at, you know, scaling back the use of red bikes so that people that might have criminal intent don't necessarily have a way to get around as easy. Same goes for the electric scooter, the rental scooters that are available downtown. And again, looking at the most violent crimes, homicides and shootings, juvenile involvement in those is not particularly different than it's ever been. But as Chief Thigee has said on multiple occasions, a proliferation of property crime. We look at crime in these two big buckets. There's property crime, thefts, and everything, and then there's violent crime, shootings and robberies. And when we look at when there's a big proliferation of this property crime, it's people still don't feel safe, even though they wouldn't necessarily get hurt or there wouldn't necessarily be something bad happening to them physically. It still is a, you know, Thigee has really talked about the perception of how things are, especially in the entertainment districts and in downtown where a lot of people come in to the city.
Yeah, it's certainly a violation.
And if I can follow up with that real quick too, Lucy. So looking at the Street Crimes Task Force in particular, and this is not necessarily indicative of the whole department's efforts, but that task force is focused right now on part one violent crime, which is shootings and homicides, also burglary, theft from autos, and auto thefts. That is expected to change week to week, even depending on the data. And the neighborhoods, which also could change week to week, that they're focused on right now or so far are the Central Business District, which Cameron mentioned, Over the Rhine, Walnut Hills, Westwood, West Price Hill, Quarryville, and Avondale.
Becca, I understand that this roving task force that we've been talking about has made a lot of drug-related arrests. Can you talk about that? Is that having an impact on violent crime?
Yeah, so I think I mentioned earlier that the number of total arrests in this kind of first full week of operation for the task force was 53. And police say more than 60% of those arrests were drug-related. Now, when Thigee gave that information, she was quick to clarify, this is not a drug task force. They're not targeting drugs necessarily as their focus in reducing crime. But she said there's a strong correlation between drug use and drug crimes and other crimes, especially violent crimes. So although it's not a specific target, it is something that has come up a lot. 25% of the arrests were firearm related. That's another thing that, they are kind of focused on firearms specifically. But there tends to be a lot of overlap between firearm-related offenses and other violent crimes that the city is trying to reduce. I did just today put in a records request for all of the arrest reports for those 53 because, 60% being drug-related, we don't really know what that means. Is it distribution? Is it possession? In which case, is that really indicative of anything? But obviously don't have that information back yet.
And were any of those guns recovered illegal guns? Did they talk about that?
So illegal gun can mean different things. Mm-hmm. A lot of the times someone possessing a gun, it can be illegal if, you know, they have a felony and are not supposed to have a weapon. It can also be, and we don't have information about that number, 12 firearms were recovered. So I would guess that some of those include people who had a gun and weren't supposed to have a gun because of a felony on their record. Two of those firearms were stolen, so illegal because they belonged to someone else. And you know, whether or not that person stole it or bought it from someone else or, you know, received it from someone else. So two of the 12 confirmed stolen. That said, you know, not everyone reports that their gun was stolen. You know, it's something that people may feel uncomfortable reporting to the police. So it's likely that at least a couple of those guns were also stolen, even if they weren't confirmed stolen by police.
Cameron, what was the mood at this press conference, for lack of a better word? I mean, you know, you mentioned that overall shootings are way down year to date, but anytime somebody gets shot and killed, that's a tragedy for that family, that person. I mean, it sounds like the city is not taking a victory lap. Were there members of the community there?
No, there's the crux of these press conferences, and they are holding them far more regularly than they have in years past. I think this is the third press conference of the year that they've had, and they these are mostly in response to an outcry from specifically Sarah Herringer, who was the wife of Patrick Herringer, who was murdered in their Over the Rhine home a few weeks ago. And she's been very outspoken, and she's sort of, I don't necessarily think she's done this intentionally, but people have rallied around that, especially business owners in Over the Rhine, other people who are generally concerned with rising crime rates. And you look at other cities and you see things that much worse. And I think people see that and they don't want that to happen here. Philadelphia, for example, over the 4th of July weekend had 46 people shot in just one weekend. So when you hear numbers like that and you see it happen nationally, I think people generally are kind of, and with the kind of the inspiration from that Sarah gave people to kind of speak out, and try to hold the city accountable, they're responding by holding these press conferences, pretty frequently.
Well, I've been talking with WVXU local government reporter Becca Costello, Cincinnati Enquirer investigative reporter Dan Horn, and Cincinnati Enquirer breaking news reporter Cameron Knight. Thank you all for your time today. Up next, could a lawsuit over the state's funding plan for a new Brown Stadium be bad news for Hamilton County? This is Cincinnati Edition. Ohio Governor Mike DeWine signed a new state budget, but not without some vetoes. And a provision he didn't veto is now the subject of a lawsuit. You're listening to Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. Joining me in this recorded interview to talk about the state budget, the vetoes, and the lawsuit are Cincinnati Enquirer political reporter Haley B. Miller and Cincinnati Business Courier staff reporter and columnist Chris Wetterick. Welcome back, Haley and Chris.
Great to be here.
Thanks for having me.
Haley, we haven't talked about Ohio's state budget since the governor signed the bill. Governor DeWine did veto parts of the legislation related to property taxes. Explain what he did.
Yeah, so there were a few different ideas in this budget related to property taxes. And DeWine said, taken together, this would hurt school districts too much, imposed too many restrictions on what they can do. So the big one that DeWine vetoed is this idea that county budget commissions could basically return property taxes back to taxpayers if school districts carry over more than 40% of their budget each year. The thesis of this is that Republicans feel like schools are sitting on a bunch of cash that they're not using and, you know, therefore shouldn't be levying more money to pay for their services. School districts, of course, say that they're looking at it the wrong way. You know, they're trying to be fiscally responsible and save money like we all do. So they were very concerned about that. There are also some things that DeWine vetoed that would eliminate certain types of levies and allow county budget commissions to also reduce taxes if they just decide that tax collisions are excessive or just not necessary.
And now I know Republican state lawmakers are planning to convene to try to override some of those vetoes. Which ones are they talking about wanting to override?
So it's most of them. Notably, they are not addressing the carryover funding when they come back on July 21st. They're looking to override some of these, I guess, smaller policies. I mean, small in the sense that, you know, I feel like this carryover thing was really the hallmark of their property tax plan. And for one reason or another, they're not dealing with that right now. But they seem to think that they're going to be able to override DeWine's veto on some of this other stuff.
Is there any doubt this Republican supermajority will be able to override those other vetoes?
I think the support is there. This will start with the House before it goes to the Senate. And, you know, I think lawmakers in general were really frustrated by DeWine's vetoes on property taxes, because you've had Ohioans saying for years now that the legislature needs to do something on property tax relief. DeWine's solution in vetoing these was to say, hey, let's form a working group and study this issue, which the legislature did a couple years ago. So I do think the votes are there. I think perhaps the carryover funding is a slightly trickier calculation, and that's why it's not on the agenda this month.
Even though the carryover funding was the big topic of debate, I know, during the last few months with the budget, what will it mean for school districts and local governments if Republicans do override these other vetoes that relate to property taxes? Haley, will that be a problem for them?
They are concerned about these other measures as well. They say it will limit their ability to put certain types of vetoes on the ballot and collect money in different kinds of ways.
You know, certain going types back of to levies this, on the ballot?
Yeah. Yep. And going back to this county budget commission thing, you know, there's a concern there that, you know, what are the criteria going to be for that? I mean, how are county officials going to decide if a school district's getting too much money? And, you know, what if the school districts disagree with that? So there's a lot of uncertainty there and a lot of concerns overall that this could eat into local school funding.
Chris, another controversial provision in the state budget relates to funding for a new Cleveland Browns stadium project. Remind us where that money would come from.
It comes from the state's unclaimed property fund, which is a fund where the state collects old, you know, security deposits that you may have put on an apartment that you never collected or that the landlord didn't pay you back, but they owe you. Bank accounts that you may have forgotten about and they've, you know, expired or whatever. So there's about $4.8 billion in that fund. And so the legislature voted to allow $1 billion of it to be moved into a special fund for stadiums and cultural attractions. And they earmarked specifically $600 million for the new Browns Stadium in Brook Park, Ohio, which is a suburb of Cleveland. And the remaining money can be applied for. Theoretically, the Cincinnati Bengals and Hamilton County will probably try to get a chunk of that.
And Haley, now Ohio's former attorney general is suing over this provision.
What's wrong with it is it belongs to somebody else. And in our constitution in Ohio and the U.S. Constitution both prohibit taking private property, the government from taking private property without compensating the people from whom they're taking it.
Tell us more about the lawsuit.
So we knew this was happening because they gave us a sneak preview before the budget, but former Ohio Attorney General Mark Dan and former lawmaker Jeff Crossman, they're both Democrats. They say that this is unconstitutional because there are protections in the Constitution basically for how and when a government can seize private property, little thing known as eminent domain. And they say that the money and the unclaimed funds account belongs to the people of Ohio, and it's not something that the state should just be able to take control of.
What does the state's attorney general think?
So his position's pretty interesting. He says it's legal. even though he is really not a big fan of this plan, he urged Governor DeWine to veto it. That obviously didn't happen, but, you know, despite his own misgivings about it, you know, he called it bad public policy, but he thinks that Dan and Crossman are making an argument that's not going to hold up in court.
Haley, what have Republican legislative leaders said about this lawsuit?
You know, they just think it's a bunch of baloney, more or less. You know, Dan has kind of an interesting history as attorney general, and lawmakers, especially Republicans, have been quick to point that out. And, you know, they believe, of course, that their plan is legal. I talked to Senator Jerry Serino about this a little while back, and he said, you know, if we thought it was unconstitutional, we wouldn't have put it in the budget, but we'll see what, you know, the court says about it. The first stop will be Franklin County Common Pleas Court, which could be a little bit more favorable to the plaintiffs, but, you know, who knows where it goes from there.
Yeah. Chris, do people still have a chance to claim this money from the state?
Yeah, they have until, if I understand that law correctly, they have until 2036 to claim the funds that the state has now before they lose the right to them. And then after that, money that's more than 10 years old will be moved over to this fund. Before the law was passed, they were people. If you had this money in there, if you had money in there and it was 30 years from now, you could still go ahead and collect it.
And you, and I understand that there are some local officials urging people get that money.
Yes. Hamilton County Treasurer Jill Schiller, who is a Democrat, urged people to take a look and see whether they have unclaimed funds there. And, you know, just kind of reminding people that this is their money. This doesn't belong yet to any of the professional football teams or cultural attractions that could get a hold of it. And so she is urging them to do that. I thought it was an interesting move, given that she is a Democrat, as is almost all of our county government here in Hamilton County. But the county commissioners are very much depending on this money to maybe enhance the Bengals lease extension deal that they struck a few weeks ago.
Yeah, they were originally hoping for $350 million from the state, weren't they?
They were. They're, if I understand the law correctly, they are really only going to be eligible to get $250 million from the fund because there's a cap on it. We don't exactly understand how the procedure is going to work to apply for it, but they're certainly going to want a piece of it.
Hmm. Well, Chris, the governor vetoed another item in the budget that's important to the film industry locally. Explain what he did there.
Yeah, he vetoed the sunsetting of the film and theater production tax credit after fiscal year 2027. Just a reminder that fiscal years in the state start on July 1st, so that would really end it a year from now, basically, on July 1st, 2026. So he vetoed the end of that program. The folks here in Cincinnati who try to attract films to shoot here, it's called Film Cincinnati, they were very pleased by this. They had lobbied the governor personally on this, and so they were very happy. The thing to remember about this tax credit is that we would not see these movies filmed here without it, and it would basically be the end of the film industry in Cincinnati. Their argument is, of course, that, you know, you don't, it's not just that Brad Pitt or whoever shows up here and films a movie. There are people in town now who have, you know, who have these skills to do the, you know, behind the scenes work, and that is their livelihood. And so that is the argument for this tax credit.
Chris, do you know why the legislature wanted to eliminate this tax credit program in the first place?
I'm not exactly sure why this specific one, but if I understood what the legislators were doing, they were trying to they were trying to end some of these tax breaks so that they could implement the flat tax that's in the budget bill.
Oh. Well, Chris, how did the governor explain his veto?
His argument is the film and theater production tax credit, they attract major film companies and theater productions. and they bring jobs here. And they also, when these movies are shot here, they highlight Ohio's appeal as a destination to live, work, and visit. And if they're not here, we won't be able to compete with other states in those industries.
Well, Chris or Haley, have either of you heard whether lawmakers might try to override this particular veto?
I have not.
Yeah, I haven't heard. I think the property tax stuff is the priority right now. For everything else, the legislature actually has until December 2026 to veto any of, or to, excuse me, to override any of DeWine's budget vetoes. That's based on the legislative session schedule. So plenty of time. I would say that this, to me, seems like small potatoes compared to some of the other things that DeWine vetoed that they care a lot more about, but you never know.
Yeah. You mentioned they have until just the end of 2026, I guess, the end of this legislative session. How typical is that to come back long after these vetoes are made by the governor and try to override them? I mean, is that standard to come back like months or, you know, even a year later to override a veto?
It's certainly happened before. I know with the legislation dealing with the local tobacco bans, I can't remember what the exact timeline was, but the legislature came back and voted to override that veto well after, you know, that was included in one of the budgets. So, you know, they definitely have time. It, again, just depends how much of a priority something is. And, you know, DeWine issued, I believe, 67 vetoes this time around. So they, to some extent, are going to want to prioritize. Otherwise, they're going to be spending a lot of time overriding vetoes.
Yeah. And I'm sure there's other stuff they want to get done. Okay. Well, I've been talking with Cincinnati Enquirer political reporter Haley B. Miller and Cincinnati Business Courier staff reporter and columnist Chris Wetterich. Thank you both so much for your time today.
Thank you.
Thanks, Lucy.
Up next, Indiana public broadcasting stations are eliminating an entire statewide team of reporters and editors. We'll discuss what that means for the news you hear. This is Cincinnati Edition. You're tuned to Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. Funding cuts have reached Indiana's public broadcasting stations. Joining me in this recorded interview to explain what's happening and what it will mean for all of us is Indiana Capital Chronicle Editor-in-Chief Nikki Kelly. Welcome to the program, Nikki.
Thanks for having me.
We appreciate your being here. Explain the cuts that Indiana public broadcasting stations announced this week. Which positions are being cut and when is all that happening?
Yeah, so the consortium of the stations, both television and radio, have, I guess, co-funded a statewide reporting team for about a decade, maybe a little under. And it's an eight-person team of editors and reporters. There's, for instance, a health reporter, a statehouse reporter, a employment and labor reporter, an education reporter, and there's some digital folks and some editors. So it's that team that will be going away at the end of the year.
How did the stations explain these cuts? Why are they happening?
Well, the state lawmakers here in Indiana, when they put together their two-year budget, which just went into effect July 1st, they removed the entire line item that went to Indiana Public Broadcasting. It was about $3.6 million a year, so over $7 million over a two-year period. Indiana's budget was tight, and basically all programs got at least a 5% cut, if not more. However, public broadcasting at the very, it was holding steady. It was in the budget, all their versions, until the very end after they got some kind of downgraded fiscal news. And instead of reducing it, they just eliminated it altogether.
And you said that's $3.6 million a year. That wasn't per biennium, that was per year?
That's per year. So over the biennium, it's over $7 million that these stations have lost. So my understanding is they had to come up with, you know, how to cope with that loss. And, you know, I think they decided to focus their resources on their local content, using their local reporters in the communities that they have.
Yeah. Do we know what percentage of their budget is made up of this state funding or federal funding for that matter?
From what I understand, it differs per station. You know, some stations it's, you know, 5 to 10% of their funding. Some stations it's more. So it's sort of differing depending on the television station or their particular radio station. But everyone saw cuts of some kind. And so I think they were basically paying, for lack of a better word, dues to fund this statewide team. And they decided that that was, you know, what they would have to sacrifice.
Do you know how long the state has been funding Indiana public broadcasting stations like this?
Oh, gosh. I've been covering since 99, and it's always been around that I know of. I do know during one downturn, there was a gap period where they didn't fund it, but then it returned after state revenues kicked up. Obviously, we're in a different political cycle now with the focus coming from the Trump administration to defund NPR and public journalism in general. So, I think that would be a harder thing to see it come back.
You mentioned that Indiana lawmakers had this difficult financial forecast right before they had to finalize the state budget. What were lawmakers up against?
Yeah, so, I mean, we had a tight budget in general just because all the COVID money is gone. I think everything had sort of returned to normal, right? And so it was already a little tight. Medicaid is, in particular, had been growing a lot. And then, you know, I think about a week before session was set to end, there was a revenue forecast, and that's the normal process they use. And it said basically it was $2 billion less in revenue than they thought they were going to have when they were planning the two-year budget. So they had to make about $2 billion in cuts in under a week before they could finalize the budget.
Ugh, that's brutal. Was there much discussion or debate about eliminating this money for public media?
No. I mean, I know during the year there might have been an occasional mention of it in a hearing where people testified, you know, supporting it. But in terms of the final budget, you know, it was given to reporters the day before the vote. And actually, we were given details of it. I don't think we realized the public broadcasting cut till the morning of the vote, the final vote, which was way late in the evening. And so after midnight. Mm. So, you know, it really didn't have a lot of time to be discussed there in the final days because there was, at the time it became known, we had less than 24 hours before it was, you know, the vote was done. Mm-hmm.
You mentioned the Trump administration's approach to public media, and of course, President Trump and many Republicans have criticized NPR as being biased in favor of Democrats and against Republicans. Did any criticisms like that surface as part of this decision-making process?
Well, I've definitely heard those criticisms. I've received a lot of feedback in the last week from the story I wrote, basically saying, you know, these journalists are liberal and they don't deserve public funding. I will say that I do think those sentiments are largely aimed at national NPR. And if people sat down and looked at some of the work these reporters do on a daily basis, it's incredibly good, basic, down the middle of the road journalism, you know, and I included, you know, whether it's reporting on an updated numbers for the voucher report or a feature on the Court of Appeals taking appeals on the road. I mean, they do all kinds of good journalism. And I do feel like they're kind of getting lumped into a national perspective.
You know, President Trump and the Trump administration, there's also this talk in Congress about cutting the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, cutting this federal funding for NPR and public radio and public TV stations. Did those potential cuts in federal funding play a role in this Indiana Public Broadcasting Station's decision?
Look, it was not mentioned publicly. Publicly, lawmakers, legislative leaders focused on the fiscal situation Indiana was in. But the fact is, Indiana is an incredibly Republican state who very much supports Donald Trump. And, you know, to act like this decision was made in a vacuum without, you know, somewhat being played into the national discourse on this, I think is, you know, not realistic.
Yeah. And did the Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations collaborative make mention of the threat of federal funding? I mean, did they say that was part of their rationale for eliminating all these jobs?
Well, I mean, they just said, hey, we lost all our funding, so we have to cut some, some jobs. And So they definitely made clear that this is the hand they've been dealt, and those cuts come with consequences, and now we're seeing them.
Yeah. Tell us a little bit more about these reporters and what they've been covering. Brandon Smith, a State House reporter in Indiana, has been on our program a number of times, but can you tell us just a little bit more about them and the work they do?
Yeah, I mean, Brandon, you know, I've known him for years and years. I would say he's one of the most respected journalists in the State House by lawmakers. So I'm sure that some of the lawmakers are, you know, going to feel very bad because he's not a very, you know, partisan person. He just sort of comes in, does his work, and moves on. He does a lot of informative reporting. So, you know, I think he and some of the other reporters are pretty well respected, and that's where I think we're getting at the, not confusion, but we're comparing national to state. I've yet to have anyone, you know, really send me stories that they think are inappropriate from this reporting team. You know, I just pulled up their website where we're chatting. There's a story on proposed changes to environmental rules. There's a discussion of free vision and vaccines for school return. There's an issue about a curfew change in Indiana. There's a story on the Secretary of State moving forward to check voter registration for proof of citizenship. I mean, they're very, you know, normal journalism that I don't think calls into question anyone's, you know, I guess, agenda.
Yeah, we certainly air a lot of those stories on WVXU, and we will miss them. So,
yes.
Well, I've been talking with Indiana Capital Chronicle Editor-in-Chief Nikki Kelly. Thank you so much for your time today, Nikki.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. Our producer is Selena Reeder. Associate producer is Harper Carlton. Technical director is Carlos Lopez-Cornu. If you miss our program live, you can find Cincinnati Edition wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Lucy May. Thanks for listening.